Where do I put this fire? This bright red feeling. This tiger lily down my mouth. He wants to grow to 20 feet tall. I've left Bethlehem and I feel free. I've left the girl I was supposed to be. And someday I'll be born. I'm so tired of being shy. I'm not that girl anymore. I'm not that straight A anymore. Now I wanna sit my legs wide open and laugh so loud that the whole damn restaurant will turn and look at me. Look at the tiger jumping out of her mouth.
Welcome to the end of 2008 on Yin Radio. Today's theme is predictable for this time of year. Yep, I've collected some of the best pieces from 2008 and compiled them for this Best of 2008 program. It is an eclectic mix. I've got politics and astronomy and motherhood and sex and, well, it's a bunch of stuff all rolled up into one package, just like life. From KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, this is Yin Radio, and it's the best of 2008. Now, installment number one comes from May of 2008, the show The Name Game. During the introduction to the show, I shared excerpts from an author from a reading that she had done. Author Susan Power presented this reading from her soon-to-be-published fictional work, Our Lady of the New World. In the excerpt, the character that she's reading, an old Ojibwe woman, describes how she got her name.
I got my name because of the way I came into the world. I was early. You know, I took my mother by surprise. She was all alone in our little shack doing quill work when her water broke. And then, so soon after that, I came tumbling out. She said it felt like I did all the work, swam and pushed and tore away from her because I was ready to get started. I didn't cry. I sighed with satisfaction, the way the Creator must have when He set this world in motion. I approved of my birth and was pleased. So they called me Ogiman Gishigukwe, Chief Woman of the Sky, because I was bossy from the first minute.
Now, later in the reading, Susan Power touched on the power of names to call people. To call them in a deeper and more mysterious way than simply calling them to dinner. In this passage, the old woman is talking about her first husband, her late husband, and it was not a good marriage.
You might notice that as I'm telling you this, I haven't used his name. I say my first husband, or him, because if I speak his name now that he is gone, it is like calling his spirit, and I don't want to do that. I want his spirit to stay wherever it is.
Yes, the power of names to evoke is clear. Just as the reciprocal is true, by not naming, the person disappears. That's why the old protocol of taking away women's names and making them be Mrs. John Doe can be so offensive. The practice erases the identity of the woman, just as in Susan Power's reading, her character wanted to keep the spirit of her dead husband totally dismissed, simply by not naming him. Now, because Susan's stories incorporate the importance of naming and birthing, I asked her to tell me more about the importance of names, especially as it relates to her own name, Susan Power.
First, let me say, I mentioned in here my mother. I call her the Gathering of Storm Clouds Woman, and that is her Dakota name. It's Machpea Bohawi, which means Gathering of Storm Clouds Woman, or Stormy for short. And her siblings have said, oh, yeah, it was a good name. So my name was given to me. In my tribe, you're supposed to give your name only once to one person. And my grandmother gave me her name, which is Wanach Chawashdewi, which is the name of a prairie flower that is, it's pretty, but it's really stronger than you think. It sort of survives in really rugged desert-like terrain. Maybe that's appropriate. But Susan, my parents just gave me the two most boring names, Nina, or Susan and Mary, and stuck them together. I don't know. And power comes from the Irish side, actually, of the family. And apparently there's a town somewhere in Ireland where there are an awful lot of people with that name running around. But yeah, I like it. I don't know. Now I've grown into it, and now I think I've claimed it.
Author Susan Power and the Importance of Names from the May 3rd, 2008 show.
Stretch your name into the fabric of this world. Before you go, your skin will tear under the pressure, make it deep. So it always shows. Stretch your name into the fabric of this world. Before you go, your skin will tear under the pressure, make it deep. So it always shows.
Up next, installment number 2, Christina Mangiapane sat down with me shortly before her college graduation to record this next installment, Ex-Con My Mom. She shared with me, and now with you, her experience as a young teen coping with an absent father and an addicted, convicted, and imprisoned mother. I picked this one for the best of 2008 for a number of reasons. I find it a touching story about someone I know and love. It informs me about a fact of life for many people, arrest, jail, conviction, that is not even known to those of us who've not experienced it. So it's a hidden fact of life. And because this story was picked up by Listen Up Northwest, which airs on around 10 stations around the northwestern United States. Here's my conversation at the kitchen table with Christina from March 2008.
You have gone to prison to visit your mom.
I sure have.
Not many people do it.
Right. I didn't want to do it.
So tell me, how old were you?
I think I was 16, maybe 15, but closer to 16 if not. So about 16 when I went to go visit her.
So, I don't know, maybe we should start with background before I go into that experience, because you weren't living with her at the time.
No.
Okay, so give me some background. How did this come to be?
Well, my mom went to prison for a felony DUI, which basically means to get put into prison and you have to have the felony part of the DUI. And what the felony means is you either severely injured or killed someone. And I never went to find out if she actually killed anyone. I didn't really care to know. I didn't, you know. But nonetheless, in prison. And that was a while. I mean, the accident happened long before she was actually sent to prison.
How long did that process take? From your memory?
About at least a year before she was actually in prison, maybe even 2 years. So it was a while, and within that 2 year span, I had actually gone and gotten emancipated in the court system in Las Vegas by myself, because I didn't have any money or any lawyer or anything like that. So I spent hours a day at the self-help center in the county courthouse, filling out paperwork, filing paperwork, and things like that, all while going to high school and working. So when she was in prison, I was living either by myself or bouncing around friends' houses, living, renting rooms, sleeping on couches, whatever.
Did you start the emancipation process because of this going on with your mom, or was she still at home, or, I mean, was she in jail while...
What happened was, the accident happened and our situation was horrible. My brother and sister were living with me. My older brother was living with us as well, and he left. And so it was myself and them, my younger brother and younger sister, and it was just a horrible situation. So I decided that I needed them to move, and I moved with them to Florida to live with my grandparents, and I stayed there for a year while they got acclimated and moved back to Las Vegas by myself. At that time, my mom was going through hearings, and I thought, you know, I'm going to help because I'm always can help everyone all the time. So I got an apartment and I had her live with me. She wasn't working or anything like that. And then when eventually after all these hearings and the courts and all that stuff, the final hearing came where they decided that she was going to prison. And it was after she was in prison that I decided that I needed to be emancipated because I was by myself and I had no guardian to sign off on simple things for attending high school and things like that. So,
yeah. The one aspect of it is being the caretaker for her. You kind of gave up on that when she went to prison?
Sort of. It was within the process. When I moved back, I thought I can help. It was a compilation of a lot of things. Our situation that was going on previously before I had moved the kids to Florida, it was just a mess. I mean, police at our house every single day, and I would call the police, and they would say, well, what apartment are you calling from? And I would say, this apartment. And they're like, you're in the same apartment that you're complaining about? I said, yeah, I am. And I have no idea how we weren't taken away by child services, which was the last thing that I wanted. But I did want the situation to be corrected. But I thought that coming back, I thought, okay, now she's on her own again. She needs some help because she's on her own. She doesn't know how to get back on her feet. And it turns out that not only did she not know she wants how to get back on her feet, but she had absolutely no drive to get back on her feet. There was nothing, and there's nothing that I could have done to help. So, yeah. And so over the course of that time living with her, before she went to prison, I sort of saw how things not only hadn't changed, but had worsened, and there was just nothing that I could do.
Do you think that that's the time frame where you became jaded about her and or?
Yes, absolutely. And yeah, and more so even when she went to prison and just nothing was her fault. There has to be some kind of responsibility. You have to be self-accountable for something. I mean, I wasn't drunk. I wasn't driving. I didn't do. Come on. I mean, you wouldn't be in prison if, you know, there was absolutely no validity to the story. So, I mean, and obviously that was, you know, an effect of the drugs, the alcoholism.
Did it feel like any sense of relief when she finally did get sent to prison?
Yes. Yes, it did. Very much so. And it was odd. It was bittersweet because it was like, all right, she's going to prison. She's getting what she needs, let alone deserves. And she's going to get clean. And this is going to be a great thing. It's going to be a great thing. She's going to have a lot of time to think and come to grips with what's happened. At the same time, although I had felt like I'd been living alone and taking care of things all by myself for 2-3 years, I was actually alone and taking care of things all by myself. That was tough, but
why was that tough if all of a sudden the weight of taking care of her was gone?
Because this new weight of holy moly, I'm actually by myself. I don't think it kicked in until friends started coming over and realizing that I was by myself and acknowledging it, because I hadn't really acknowledged it because I felt by myself anyhow, you know, and I didn't have to take care of anyone anymore. But when friends would be like, whoa, so this is all yours now, or this is your apartment, yeah. It's different when you're in high school and you don't have parents and you're by yourself. So When other people started pointing it out, I kind of realized it, but didn't really faze me all that much. Mm-hmm. So,
was the trip to visit the one, two, multiple trips to visit her? Was that anything to write home about?
It was interesting, to say the least. I had visited her once in prison and once when she was in halfway house. The one time I visited her in prison was for her hearing, whether or not she would make parole. And I felt obligated to, I hadn't visited her, and she was in prison for I don't know how long.
Years?
At least a year, maybe two. And I hadn't visited her once. I'd never written her. I'd never, except to get my petition for emancipation. But I knew she had been writing me, and I knew about this hearing, and I felt obligated to go and plead for her. And then once I got there, I realized she is not ready to be out of prison at whatsoever. I stood behind her nonetheless, hoping for the best, and she got time in a halfway house, which I thought, great, you know, it's going to be wonderful. When I went to visit her at the halfway house, you're required to go to a meeting, an AA meeting, before you're allowed to see. If you don't go to the meeting, then you're not allowed to see the people that live there. So went to the meeting, and that was, I felt very detached from everything. Like, I didn't want to accept the fact that I was a part. I shared experiences with these other people, which was another reason why I hadn't visited, because I didn't want to be a part. The reason why I went to visit her in the halfway house was because my boyfriend at the time wanted to meet her against my, you know, better judgment. But that's why we went and saw her. But it seemed like the halfway house had a lot more requirements, hoops to jump through, than the prison did. I mean, all you had to do in the prison was sign in at the big bland window for me to jump through. Yeah. And was a lot, the way she lived in the prison, as far as I knew, it was like its own little society. You did whatever you wanted. I mean, within the confines of the prison, I mean, trading food, trading cigarettes, there's a new currency, but things work the same. She still had a purpose. She still worked in the kitchen. She still, you know, wrote or went outside or worked out.
But she didn't have a job before. So she
right.
may have had something more.
Exactly. And so you would think, this person's ready to be a part of the community again. This person has been, I can't even think of a word. They're ready to rejoin society and be a productive citizen. But that just wasn't the case. And immediately after she was sent from prison to the halfway house, there they don't provide jobs for you. So it's a controlled environment where you're only allowed to leave at certain times of the day. You're required to find employment within a certain amount of time that you're there, but it has to be outside. You know, they're going to monitor you, make sure that you're not using. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, you sort of need to find your way back into the world again. A part of being in the halfway house is you have to attend AA meetings. And while you're there, obviously they can control that. But once you've found acceptable employment, which only a handful of places hire ex-cons, and most of which are places where the majority of the ex-cons work, and the majority of the people released fall right back into the site. So essentially she was working at a place where everything all over again. There's drugs available, there's this available, there's that available. And so essentially she did end up fooling the system, and I mean getting employed but not really working that much, but having proof that, hey, I have this piece of paper that says I'm employed, and then eventually getting released. never attending not one AA meeting after she was released.
And didn't get back into prison or anything?
And never got reprimanded for it.
Let's wrap up with current stuff. She's pretty much dependent. She has been dependent on her folks now. You avoid going home.
Yes.
A lot because of her.
Yes.
And all that. And she is dying.
Yes. She... See if I can even remember the name of the disease now. And I don't think that I can. But it's a blood disease. Sort of. I don't know. She's bleeding in the brain or... Something about the clotting is malfunctioning. And she's been in and out of the hospital. And I think that she's back in the house now. She doesn't have a lot of time left. I don't know how much. But she's completely... I don't know. There's absolutely no way for her to ever be a functioning person again. She can never have a regular job. She can never be on her own. And her parents, my grandparents, where she's living, can't see that. And they don't understand because they had no idea what was going on. They still really don't know. But they're seeing this disease as a cop-out, as a way of saying, you know, our daughter wasn't an alcoholic, she wasn't a drug addict, she wasn't a weak person. She had this blood disease that killed her. And that's really convenient for them.
And you see?
And I see a person who made the worst decisions that they ever could have, when they had everything. It just doesn't make any sense. She had 4 children who loved her. She was best friends with. Did everything with. We confided in her. And she chose to take this path, and where has it gotten her? And what's really sad, I can't even see her anymore, and... It's really unfortunate.
Do you think that maybe, among anything else, you're pissed off at her?
I was for a very long time. I was so resentful of my older brother for having left, which there were circumstances, you know.
Yeah, you can understand it, but.
Right. And then being a teenager, a 14-year-old kid living in this environment, and your older brother, granted, he did things very differently, and we still have very different points of view, and we're very different people, but I've come to understand his point of view versus my point of view. He thinks long-term, I think short-term. He thinks, how am I going to get us out of this for life? And I think, what can I do right now? And so that was very different, and I didn't know that then.
So you're putting food on the table and he's trying to become a doctor.
Exactly. Which is the perfect balance. But then I'm like, the hell are you thinking, leaving me here by myself with these kids? And
do you think you'll ever forgive your mom? And do you need to?
Maybe one. I don't know. Maybe one day. I mean, I'm still. It still bothers me. I don't know if I would go as far to say that I'm upset about it still or angry about it still. But it does still bother me sometimes to think. I don't know. Here I am, graduating from college, working a ton of jobs, and I don't know, just not having that support or that place to turn that is supposed to be there. And I mean, I haven't had it for however long, but you just, it's these moments in your life when you've accomplished something that you think, man, I wish.
Christina has since graduated and is doing a year of volunteer service as a teacher in the AmeriCorps program. She's applying to grad school. Christina's mom is still alive, although they've not seen each other since before this piece was recorded. This is Yin Radio, and today we're doing the best of 2008. Installment number 3, Astro Mom. In 2008, National Astronomy Day and Mother's Day were back-to-back. It was a conjunction that just had to be noticed, so I noted it with this story. It's from Lynn Hillenbrand. Lynn Hillenbrand is an astronomer at the California Institute of Technology in Pasadena, where she teaches and does research. Her focus is on observational astronomy, working at the big telescopes around the world to learn more specifically about the formation of stars and planets. In February 2008, Lynn and I attended day-long meetings together as board members of the Astronomical Society of the Pacific. Despite being mentally drained after the day-long meeting, Lynn sat down with me to talk for Yin Radio, and we talked about her work and about her role as a mom.
I use facilities in Hawaii and California, sometimes Chile. And the work is not what it used to be in terms of looking through an eyepiece and or exposing for hours and hours on a photographic plate and then walking through the dark to try to develop the plate. It's much different today. It's, you know, computer-based. The telescopes are computer-controlled and the instruments are computer-controlled. And so the astronomers go and basically sit in front of computers and have some simulation of the optics in the instrument in front of them and arrange the computer GUIs and so on, arrange the computer controls so that the light gets to the detector. And so, I mean, it's really all computer-based. So there's an image of the sky, and so you have some sense. One has some sense of the sky, but obviously you're removed and in some interior room and not necessarily right next to the telescope you're also warm, yes, and there's a coffee machine and a microwave and a bathroom. You know, so there's some exposure to the sky. It's always good to go out and look at the weather, and, you know, it's silent, quiet, and of course dark, and so there's still that romantic sense that exists of the astronomer alone at the telescope and experiencing the night sky. So you can still get that by going out, of course, and just looking at the sky in these dark, very dark sites. But actual collecting of data, collecting of photons is a much different process than it used to be.
Tell me about what do you think, what would you be telling your mom is your great discovery so far? What's the neatest thing you've learned?
It's hard to say. I guess I work in a field, so my research area is in star formation and planet formation, so how stars form out of interstellar gas and dust and how planets form around those stars, which we are finding is a very frequent process or potentially frequent process. So we know that planets exist around old stars, and we see by looking around young stars the raw materials to make planets near ubiquitously. And so we see the egg and we see the chicken, and we try to connect the dots and determine how the egg turns into the chicken.
Well, so the field
that I work in is, I think it's more something that has more to do with my personality than the science, because there are a lot of people who work in my field who rush out and do press releases and tell everyone how great their science is. And that's not quite my style, right? I work on things that take big data sets and a long time to kind of get to the bottom of the picture. And so I confuse myself for years at a time, and then suddenly it all comes together and, you know, there's some major result, but it's not an aha moment, right? It's not quite analogous, but, you know, you want to say curing cancer or something, right? People have been working on this for decades. It's not going to be an aha process, right? There's a sequence of events. So some of the particularly interesting things that I've been a part of are, and some of them are technical achievements, and some of them are important scientifically. So technically, something that's been quite challenging and that we've recently figured out how to do is detect very faint objects next to very bright objects, as in planets next to stars, or maybe not quite yet planets, but objects called brown dwarfs or failed stars or even very low mass stars. So things that are significantly fainter than the stars that they orbit. And over the past 10 years, a new technology has matured and enabled these kinds of studies to be done. So I've been part of that with some students. So, finding the lowest mass object next to a star like the sun. Yeah. And it's a sequential process of, kind of marching towards being able to detect planets. And we're not there yet, but there's, we will be able to directly image planets around other stars in, probably the next 20 years or so. This will happen. And, again, it's a rapidly progressing field, and it's just driven by the technology, because we know the problem, we know what we're trying to do, and we know how hard it is. And, we just have to wait for the technology to improve.
What draws you to it more? Two things you've mentioned that sound to me appealing are what you called the romantic astronomer alone in the night sky, and then the other is the puzzle, working out the puzzle, mm-hmm. what it is. Or is there something else? What is it that trips your trigger?
I think the journey, right? I'm not so result oriented as in, I'm in it for the long haul, and there are different little subtleties or pieces that are solved along the way. But it's a long duration problem that I'm working on. As far as how I got involved in astronomy in the first place, it wasn't necessarily the romantic aspect of the night sky, because like many other people, I did have a telescope when I was young, and I found it completely frustrating because it required, too much hands-on, and, the Earth would rotate and whatever I was looking at would go out of the field of view, and it was too much hassle, it was too much work. So I never liked the telescope, but somehow astronomy appealed to me as being the most realistic and practical application of physics. So when I had a physics class in high school, we did the usual things, inclined planes and balls on strings and pulleys and so on, and this all seemed totally artificial to me. And then one week we did a unit on gravitation and the moon orbiting the Earth, and somehow this was real, right? This is a real thing that I can see, and, here's some equations that describe it, and one can understand the real world in terms of physics, and this was somehow real, and in a way that inclined planes and springs and the other things that are taught in high school physics wasn't. So that's really how I first got involved. I was not really a hobbyist or an amateur. It was.
But were you a nerd?
Of course. I was a nerd, and I'm still a nerd, and we can just celebrate that. And
yes, we can. Now, talked about staying up all night, and that makes me wonder, it's related to my question about your schedule. I know you're crazy busy.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes you stay up all night, then you teach classes.
Mm-hmm.
So you've chosen a lifestyle that has this busy, busy schedule, and I imagine it's not for the pay, because mm-hmm. faculty members don't usually get rich, even though you can do okay. But then you also have a family. How do you do it all?
It is not easy. So I have two kids. One is 9 and one is 3.5. And so they have a bit of an age separation, which is sometimes good, and other times I feel like we're doing the same thing all over again, right? We've been through that with the 9-year-old, and now we're engaging, here we are doing the same things again with the 3-year-old. So two kids is a challenge. I think for anybody these days, it's not just women, but it's women and men, balancing professional and personal aspirations. It's a challenge for everyone. There's still probably more burden on women in this area, and especially with girls. They have some preference for mom to be around and do things with mom.
And it's your daughter that's older?
They're both girls. Two girls. So it's just not easy, and you know, we try to carve out some time that is just family time in the evenings. But because one is in school and has homework and soccer and karate and other activities, right? It's not only is my life busy, her life is busy too, and trying to coordinate all of that around work is problematic. I travel a lot, and that's certainly an issue, right? That just being away from home, the not being there at all. There are two issues. One is the hectic day-to-day schedule, and then there's the travel, either to telescopes or I go to Washington a lot for policy issues with NASA and NSF and other government organizations, and then you know, other service sorts of activities that I do. So, you know, you just have to make the time with the kids, quality time, and make sure it's appreciated by everyone. And
well, you know, I talk to a lot of women for the show in particular, and they do such a variety of things. And one thing that I think I see, I'm not sure, but I certainly hear a lot, is about women giving up things for the husband and the family. And so that's why when I see somebody who's being so successful professionally, it makes me say, well, you must be dedicated. You didn't give in to the pressures of everybody saying, you know, just, you know, if you're going to have a family, just back off. I mean, you can still be a professor, sure, but did you feel those pressures? Or are those, I mean, because I'm not sure everyone does.
Those kinds of pressures are certainly there. I think there are certain things that I have to do with my life, or I'm not going to be happy. My career, not for the sake of the career, but my career in the sense of pursuit of knowledge and finding something out. And as I said earlier, you know, working on the same problem for years and now decades is what drives me. Right, I've just got to figure something out and, you know, make a computer program work or understand what this data is trying to tell me. And you know, there are things about that I've learned about stars and about the universe that just bother me, right? They're just inconsistent. You know, how can this be? What explains this pattern that we see? And I just have to answer that. And
know
that,
you some a little bit? I mean, getting some answers?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. No, it's thoroughly satisfying. There are other things that one has to do. One has to get grants in order to perform research and work with graduate students, and that's, you know, part of the overhead of having the freedom to do science. And I mean, I just think I won't say I have the best job in the world, but I have the opportunity to spend my time in the best possible way. And that's one thing that just drives me, and I try to make other things fit in around that. At the same time, I love my kids and I enjoy spending time with them. You know, one can work too much and one can play too much, and I have, you know, there's sort of minimum requirements in each area, and you have to do that, and then you make all the other pieces fit in. But at the same time, there are sacrifices, right? There are things that I don't do, and it's more, you know, more on the personal side, things that I've given up more having to do with me, you know, like reading books or getting exercise, you know, things like that that I used to be very passionate about, and you know, sort of let things go as time goes on. So,
reading books and long showers and sleeping late are my three things that I love when I have the time, and that go quickly when I'm, yeah, being very.
Sometimes it's nice to be away in a hotel.
It is. Or on a plane.
Go to bed early.
Yeah, that's it. I loved it. It's all I could ask for. I think also that you're an excellent role model for girls who are encouraged, you know, your girls, I'm thinking in particular, who are now have an example in their own household of how to make a satisfying life. If you're doing what's so satisfying, and having the family, and having, you know, to, yeah, do some things you don't like, but, I mean, that's life.
Yeah, it's very rewarding, and, you know, each one of us kind of crafts an existence that, you know, it's workable and enjoyable at the same time. I think you're right about my daughters, and I'm very reluctant to call myself a role model because there are so many things that I could be doing better, but it was reassuring. It was several years ago now, the older one, when asked what she wanted to do when she grew up, she said, "I want to be a teacher and a mommy." The dual nature of the answer I thought was very interesting, right? It wasn't a career question and it wasn't a personal question. She answered in both ways.
Lynn Hillenbrand is a mommy and an astronomer. Now for installment number 4. It made this list because of the new insights that it provided. It was from a panel discussion, a women and politics panel discussion at the University of Idaho that was held just before this last election. In the portion of this discussion, Sandra Reinecke is talking about women being elected to office, representation and issues related to women, and women's voting patterns worldwide. Here's Women in Politics from the panel discussion. This is Sandra Reinecke.
Statistics on female political representation in the United States look grim, and I brought along some statistics in case we want to look it up. But if the United States is so far down in terms of women's representation in elected offices, who do you think is the country in the world that has the highest representation of women in its elected office? I'm sorry?
Finland.
Did you say Finland? Finland is probably number 3. The first one is Rwanda. Oftentimes we just apply these stereotypical ideas about how the world is run and what it looks like. And when you look at a map, for instance, that tells you in terms of shades who runs a country, sometimes we are surprised, for instance, surprised by the small amount of women who are involved in politics in the United States. Overall, in the United States, we have a representation of about 35%. In Sweden, it's 45%. And I'll talk a little bit about that. But if we need statistics, for instance, I have a list of women who ever ran for president and vice president. It's longer than you think. It has, I would say about 10 or 12 ladies on it, rather than just 3 that you probably could remember. So the issue here is the challenge that women face in order to become elected into representative office. And I wanted to propose 3 angles how to understand this. The first is, why don't we have more women in elected office? Are they not voting, or are they not even there? So we have, of course, the majority of U.S. citizens are women. The majority of voters are women. Women tend to vote in higher numbers than men. We have, in the 2000 election, we had 61% women participating and 58% men turning out to cast their vote. Women, on the other hand, contribute less to campaigns, and they contribute less dollars to campaigns as well. But they turn out in higher percentages to cast their ballot. However, women do tend to vote for the left party. And why do you think that is?
Social issues such as welfare reform, healthcare, and abortion rights.
And to add to it, socioeconomic status. Women make less money than men, generally, so they tend to favor, in this country, the Democratic Party. So if you do your math, more women, more women voters, more left-leaning women should give you an idea of how this election comes out. Apparently, it's still a puzzle. We talk about political representation. Once we looked at political participation, we look at political representation. So the question that everybody asks is, do women have a particular interest that they want their representative towards, for instance, the social issues that you just mentioned? And if women have a woman issue, would women represent these issues better, for instance, in Congress or in the Senate or as a president and so forth? Okay. And then, of course, if women actually were to represent women's issues better, how many of them do you have in order to achieve this? Do you have to have 50% of them, or 68, or 79.5%? So these are the kind of questions that political scientists ask themselves. Does mass matter? Do we have to have a critical mass of female representatives in order to change policy? Because just the liking for a candidate and voting for her does not necessarily make a policy change. So we wonder, if we need more women, what's the critical mass that we need in order to change policy? And here, what is in disfavor of women representation in elected office is For instance, the electoral system in the countries that we're looking at, in the United States you have what we call a single district electoral system, the winner takes all, and so parties are more reluctant to put a woman in there in case, because the assumption is that she's not able to win over the male candidate, then you're losing the entire district. Whereas countries such as Sweden, Finland, and so forth, who have a higher representation of women in elected office, they have a multiple district electoral system. Don't blame it on men, blame it on the electoral system. Of course, everybody has to work together in order to change the electoral system, but it really is an important point. So keep in mind, even if we have women on the ballot, if we have an electoral system where the winner takes all, it is harder for women to be nominated, to be on the ballot for the district. Countries like France, for instance, who also tend to have a lower number of women in elected positions because of their electoral system, what they've done, they've changed the constitution. Boom, they said, we are done with gender inequality, we're making it gender parity. So since 2001, the French constitution was changed, and since 2001, all political parties in France are required to put an equal number of men and women on their ballots. So there you go, the French. Do it before anybody else. So did it work? It didn't work. The parties don't do this, they have to pay a fine. So the parties say, okay, we'll go and pay the fine. Because we still don't want to lose to a man. And since they have the single district electoral system as well, they still find it too risky to really put a woman on there. You wonder, what are the odds against, for instance, having a female president or having a female vice president, or increasing the numbers of political representatives in Congress and Senate and in other elected state offices? Don't forget, there's all these other offices that are really, really, really important. So just to give you an idea here, historically, the first female mayor in the United States was elected in 1887. When did women gain the right to vote in the United States?
1920.
So this is 33 years prior to on the federal level, women gaining the right to vote. On the state level, it's a little bit different. The first female state legislator got into office was elected in 1894, and the first state senator from Utah was elected in 1896. By 2003, 22% of all state legislators were female. 22% of all state legislators. That's since 1896. That's more than 100 years later. You have from 0.01% to 22%. That's whooping. Your first female congresswoman was elected from Montana in 1917. That's 3 years before women gained the right to vote. In 2003, female representatives 13.6. Now keep in mind, the majority of the population in the United States is female. The first female governor, since we have a female governor being on the ticket for vice president, was elected in 1925. Again, blame it on the electoral system. And unfortunately, also there is a misperception that voters have to vote either on gender or on issues. That's a completely absurd question. No male or female voter would ever ask herself, well, should I vote for Senator Obama based on him being a male or what he thinks about the economy, right? That's completely absurd. I'll leave it at that. And
Sandra Reinecke is a professor in political science and women's studies at the University of Idaho. How could we review the best of 2008, the best of anything, and not talk about sex? Interestingly, what I selected from the September 6th show called Sex is about not having sex. I had talked to nuns at a Catholic monastery and a Buddhist abbey about sex and about choosing to not participate in sex. First, Sister Carol Ann Wasmuth of St. Gertrude's Monastery in Cottonwood, Idaho. She entered the convent at age 13, very young, even for the 1940s, but she had lots of time to consider monastic life before making a final commitment.
I was in the community for almost 10 years before I could make any kind of final commitment, so I had plenty of time to think about it. I don't think at the beginning it was that much of a question for me. Just because I was so busy having fun teaching those kids and doing all that kind of stuff. There was a time in my life when, yes, I questioned the whole celibacy thing and really started getting in touch with my own sexuality. But I think we had some very healthy input on that. You know, it wasn't like denying your sexuality. It was like looking at it and saying, okay, how do I express my sexuality? And one of the things that I realized, especially once I started working in parishes, is that I am a very strong heterosexual. You know, because that's a whole gamut, you know, and you fall somewhere on this gamut. You know, some people are stronger than other, and I am a very strong heterosexual, which simply to me means I need, in order to be healthy, I need to have interaction with men. You know, and seeing in the parish, that was no problem. I worked side by side with a lot of men and interacted with them and taught them and, you know, was on committees with them and the whole thing and had good men friends there. And see, that's the thing I really start realizing, that if I was going to be healthy, I needed to develop healthy relationships with men as well as women. They don't need to be sexual, or, well, I guess, they're always, but they don't need to be genital. I mean, you know, they can be good, healthy relationships, and that's how I would remain healthy. And when I came back to the monastery, that was, oh dear, I mean, there aren't a lot of men running around here. But then I got involved in the forest management and work with a lot of men there, and we've just gotten to be good friends, and I keep up my relationship and friends with, my friendship with the men that I knew, as well as the women. I mean, I just have very good friends, both in community, but outside community as well. And so, it's kind of funny because, of, you know, 40 years ago, I'd never believed I'd be doing this because life was very different at that time. But I have a good friend, a gentleman who used to live here at Winchester. We got to know each other when we worked together on human rights issues and worked together with the Nez Perce tribe. And he's since moved to Boise, and we stay in touch. And when I go to Boise for business or whatever, I always let him know I'm coming, and we figure out a night, and he comes, picks me up, and we go out and have a glass of wine and have dinner and have a marvelous conversation. And, I mean, it's as close to a date as you can get. I mean, it is. It's a beautiful experience, you know, and it's a great time. I thoroughly enjoy it, and he brings me back and back to my friends or wherever I'm staying. And it's something I need. And I think he also, it's a good experience for him too. And the thing is, we both know, and my other men friends too, that that's, it's never going to develop into anything else. It is just a simple friendship where we can share ideas and share, you know, fun together, and just let it be at that. And so that's, I think, a good part of this is, and it kind of slips back to what I just said, a healthy recognition of who we are and our own sexuality. And yes, I can't deny that, and I can't suppress it, and I can't say that there's anything wrong with it. I simply need to find ways that are healthy, that fit into my lifestyle, where I can take care of that need for intimacy, for that kind of friendship.
That was Sister Carol Ann Wasmuth of St. Gertrude's Monastery in Cottonwood, Idaho. Now, the Venerable Thubten Chödrön, she's an American woman, a Buddhist nun in the Tibetan tradition, and founder of the Savrasti Abbey in Northeast Washington. She embraces celibacy.
It's actually so nice to be celibate, because I find that my relationship with men is just so much easier now, you know, because I know I don't want to get involved, they know I'm not going to get involved, so then I can relate to men in a really frank, direct way, without all this, I mean, you know how you use your eyes and how you walk and this and that and the other thing to try and attract, so you don't have to bother with any of that anymore, okay? It's really rather nice.
I think it's just wonderful that you want to be a nun, and you think it might be fun to be one of the ones who's a nun.
I'm closing this best of 2008 Yin Radio program with the best musical discovery that I've made in 2008, and that's Alison Krauss. The song is This Little Bird.
This little bird has a wonderful
You can find more music from Alison Crowe at alisoncrowe.com. That's Alison with two L's and Crowe with an E on the end. You can contact Yin Radio, and please do contact Yin Radio, at yinradio@vpfound.org. That's V as in voice, P as in power, found.org. Or find us on MySpace. You can catch past shows, get podcasts, and subscribe to our e-newsletter for info about upcoming shows and for Yin Radio news. All of this at yinradio.org. Yin Radio is produced at KRFP in Moscow, Idaho by VP Foundation and by me. I'm Sandy Billings. Thanks for joining me. Until next week. Life has to offer an